Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Yes, here we are, Buzzkillers, Professor Buzzkill, and fortunately with us in the studio, Buzzkiller number one, your favorite Buzzkiller, Professor Phil Nash from Penn State. How are you, Professor?
You're far too kind. Sorry, I'm doing great.
I'm not far too kind because, as Buzzkillers might not know out there, Professor Nash brought the donuts this morning to this recording session. Not doing my Buzzkill blood pressure any good, but he's certainly very hospitable.
Have donuts, will podcast. I think that's our motto.
And Buzzkillers, we're talking this week about something that's very, very troubling. Not only what happened, but the way it has been interpreted as happening. We wanted to call this show, or at least we thought initially of calling this show, The Causes of the Civil War. But really, what we should call it, and what we have called it, is The Cause of the Civil War. Why have we done that, Professor? Remind me.
Well, just it's a not-too-subtle way of pointing out the fact that certainly in the eyes of most responsible historians, there really is one single overwhelming cause of the Civil War. It's not exclusive, right? It's not 100% slam dunk, but basically the Civil War was about slavery. That was the overwhelming cause. That was the elephant in the room.
Right. There were other causes, but they were in the lower percentile, shall we say. Slavery's more like 80-85%.
Right. Yeah. If you were to assign a number to it, yes.
That's right. I mean, we hear so many things about states' rights. We hear so many things. Well, if you take a history class, you might hear something about tariffs. But
right.
These things, as you're saying, and as you said right now, which is very, very important, all responsible historians argue these are very minor.
That's right. They're secondary or tertiary at best.
Oh,
and or to put it another way, or run the thought experiment, can you easily conceive of a civil war breaking out in 1861 if there's no slavery in the United States, right? If you sort of counterfactually remove slavery, obviously it doesn't prove anything, but it seems to me that's very, very difficult to establish, right?
You mean
that you would have had a civil war between North and South without slavery?
Over tariffs or something.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It would have been, those are all sort of more or less conventional political disagreements you would have hashed out like any other.
Right, right. You can't imagine them firing on Fort Sumter because the tariff, there's an idea for a national tariff or
yes,
something
although,
like that.
Yes, although, as we were mentioning before before this podcast, there was this sort of nullification crisis of 1833 under Andrew Jackson.
Right.
Where South Carolina talked about seceding. Not the first time a state talked about seceding, by the way. That was, I think that was during the War of 1812. But and the issue really was the tariff.
Right.
But once you get to 1861, it's all about slavery.
1868 and 1867.
That's right. Well, and in the years leading up to that, of course, as we'll discuss.
Right, the brutal 1850s. So it's not 100%, but it's very, very close to the cause.
Absolutely. And people should know, just sort of to set the background here, just how important slavery was. Because I think if you listen to some people or read some books, you might get the impression that slavery is sort of an unfortunate sort of side issue or sort of side aspect of the United States in the early 19th century.
And that it was dying.
And it was dying out. Or it's, in other words, this was basically a conventional country that, oh, by the way, happened to have some slavery going on.
Yeah. This is a wrong impression people have.
That is a completely wrong impression people have. Slavery was fundamentally important, not just to the Southern economy, but to the entire United States economy.
Oh, okay.
In the mid-19th century. Just for perspective, as of 1860, this is a country with about 31 million people total.
Yeah.
4 million of them plus are African-American slaves. So it's a big percentage of the overall population. It's a huge percentage of the Southern population. If you look at what's going to become the Confederacy.
How many whites are there in the South?
Yeah, the Confederacy, after the war breaks out, has about 9 million people, 5 million whites and 4 million black slaves. So it's not quite half the population.
Oh, my goodness.
And that, of course, doesn't even say everything about it that you need to know. As of 1860, if you take the estimated value of all the slaves in the United States, the 4 million plus slaves, it is by far the largest, the most valuable single asset in the United States. And that's compared to anything else. For example, if you compare it to all the bank deposits in the United States, slaves are worth more.
Oh, right. Because, of course, technically they have value, monetary value as,
And one of the issues in the Southern economy is that by 1860, slaves are individually expensive. Obviously, this sounds crass, but they vary in price, right? Oh, right. I mean, young, able-bodied male slave could go for $1,000 or $1,200, which back then was a ton of money.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I ran the numbers once. That's something like $30,000 today.
Wow.
And that's one of the reasons you have no social mobility in the South, is because a lot of people would love to own slaves but can't afford their first slave.
Oh, and so
it becomes a barrier to entry, basically.
The white sort of upper working class or lower middle class is hitting a slave roof, or a slave barrier.
Exactly.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Only a quarter of the Southern population owned slaves. Three quarters did not. It doesn't mean the three quarters didn't want to own slaves. It just couldn't because they were prohibitively expensive.
So the 4 million slaves that exist are only owned by the top quarter.
That's correct. Correct. Oh, wow. Absolutely right. And it's one of the reasons why the richest people in the United States in 1860 were not Northern industrialists. They were certain Southern plantation owners who owned hundreds or even, I think there were some cases, they owned over 1,000 slaves. And if you run the numbers, today they would be like Bill Gates. They'd be like billionaires.
Oh, my God.
In today's money.
How does this equate to the sort of rest of the world? I hear arguments that, slavery was everywhere in the rest of the world. But is that what the U.S. was doing,
right,
too?
The U.S. was unique. It was the largest slave-holding country on the planet. You did have slavery elsewhere, by the way. And there were countries like Brazil that abolished slavery after the United States does. But, you know, the British Empire had abolished slavery decades before.
1833.
Famously. And but the United States is unique in that regard. You do have slavery elsewhere. By the way, in other periods in other places, like in Africa earlier in particular, you had slavery, but it was a very different type.
Right.
Because a lot of neo-Confederates will say things like, Africans own slaves too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different type of slavery. By the way, it doesn't make slavery okay.
No.
From a logical standpoint. Yeah. And also, it wasn't chattel slavery. Chattel slavery where you own somebody as property.
Okay, so chattel slavery is more complete?
More complete, more intense, more brutal. You own someone as property. You own their offspring as property in perpetuity. You have a complete right to do with them as you please. By the way, states like Virginia, from the colonial period, had laws basically that said if you accidentally kill one of your slaves, you can't be punished. In other words, they explicitly protected you in case you killed one of your slaves.
So you're their god on earth. The slave owner is their god on earth.
Pretty much.
God.
So in other words, what I'm saying is not all types of slavery are the same around the world in world history. By the way, there are more slaves on the planet now than ever before in human history in 2017.
Human trafficking is making it worse.
Exactly. Yeah. But, of course, the population is much, much bigger than
it was. Sure. Yeah.
But there is the southern United States is a unique slaveholding society as of 1860.
And is there any indication that slavery or the slave-based economy is on the decline?
No, not in 1860. No, for that sort of thing, you have to look a little earlier to like 1790 when slavery was being phased out in the North.
Yep.
And there were people where, for example, in tobacco growing areas, slavery wasn't doing as well. For various economic reasons. And there were people around 1790 who could foresee a day when maybe slavery fades out because it's just not economically viable. And now, as buzzkillers may know, that's largely turned around by the cotton gin.
I was going to say, and is that true or is that one of these myths?
I'm pretty sure that's true. Okay. This really was a case where a technological breakthrough transformed an entire sector of the economy. And if you look at slave ownership and cotton production, they explode in tandem after 1793. When the cotton gin is introduced.
So you often think that technology or technological innovations sort of save labor. But in one case they take the seeds out of the cotton, but it expands labor, in this case slave labor, because the cotton has to be picked.
Right, and it makes, because people grew cotton before, but it was prohibitively expensive. It was a luxury item.
It was a luxury item because
you had to separate the seeds by hand, and it just made no sense to raise large amounts of cotton. That all changes because of that. And by 1860, cotton comes to represent more than half of the value of all U.S. exports.
Wow. So it's almost as if slavery is certainly not declining, but is certainly very, very strong, and in fact the backbone of the Southern economy.
Exactly, and entrenched. And not just the Southern economy, and this is important too, especially these days when happily it's getting more attention. For example, how some Northern interests, including elite universities, benefited from slavery.
Oh.
It's also true of the northern industrial economy in general.
Are they invested in slavery?
They're invested in slavery in some cases.
Financially.
By the way, a lot of the capital for the expansion of slavery in the South came from Great Britain.
Yes, that's right. So one of the things the British...
Foreign investment in American development is often overlooked.
Yeah, they often crow about how they've abolished slavery in 1833, but they continued profit
and,
off of it.
And, well, again, the returns were amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it
made economic sense.
Yeah.
But... you had, look at northern industrialization. The first wave of northern industrialization starts around the War of 1812, and it's textiles.
Mm.
And we're trying to get established in the face of fierce British competition.
Right.
And one of the ways we do that successfully is we have very, very cheap inputs in the form of cotton raised by slaves.
Is it 1815 or 1850?
1815 is when,
You
know, the like,
oh, the cotton gin, of course. Yeah, sorry.
But Lowell, Massachusetts, right? The modern factory system is established around 1815. And the first, it's not producing cars or producing typewriters. It's producing cloth.
Right, right. Okay.
From cheap, artificially cheap southern cotton. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I'm trying to be even-handed here. It's kind of rich later on where you're going to have northerners look down their noses at southerners as if they have completely clean hands. Like, right. Slavery is evil, and how could you possibly own another human being? At the same time, when northern economy is becoming what it is and making the United States into this economic powerhouse, largely because it has this major artificially cheap input, cotton.
Right, right. And so there's a lot of guilt to go around. It's not just
Absolutely, because if you're a country
and you're going to allow this to happen.
Right.
You know, everyone who's profiting on it is going to be partly responsible.
Yeah. And by the way, I may not get into it much, but in case I forget, people should keep in mind that even when you get into the crisis years of the 1850s, abolitionists in the North, in other words, Northerners who want to abolish slavery because it's evil, they're a minority.
Yeah.
They're a pretty small minority. They're vocal. They're very effective.
A lot of them are ministers and have sway over their
population. They scare the hell out of white Southerners.
Yeah.
But they are a minority. Mm-hmm. And even among them, fewer of them believe, for example, in black equality or black citizenship.
Right. Does that not change until emancipation, or is it before that?
Yeah, it changes. I mean, obviously, you've got some people, ironically, people like John Brown, who truly did believe that black people were equal, and he treated them like equals.
Yeah,
but a lot of abolitionists were sort of paternalistic.
Oh, sure,
You know, didn't, including Lincoln, by the way, although he really wasn't an abolitionist, technically, at least not at first.
Yeah. Not until 1863, maybe.
Right, yeah. And he changes to his credit. But, yeah, let me put it this way. Abolitionists sort of punch way above their weight.
Oh, okay. And we hear a lot about them.
We hear a lot about them.
Because, of course, they print and publish a lot of things.
Right. But numerically, they're a tiny minority. And most Northerners, really, even well into the Civil War, most Northerners are okay with slavery if it stays in the South.
Right.
They do not object to it on moral grounds.
Wow, that's a bit distressing.
We'll talk about that in a minute anyway. But there's division over slavery from the get-go.
Oh,
the
first days of the U.S., okay.
It's sort of on the table at the Constitutional Convention of 1787, mm-hmm. but to their discredit, and for some obvious reasons, because a lot of the founders were slave owners, and they're not going to create a founding document that eliminates their livelihood from a very cynical standpoint. But... They dance around the issue. The word slave, by the way, never appears in the Constitution.
Right.
But it is referred to infamously. First of all, they do talk about the slave trade. And they say you can eliminate the international slave trade after 20 years, which we do.
Okay, that's eliminated in 1807?
1807, 1808, I believe. Yeah.
Okay.
And by the way, which has the unintended consequence of promoting the internal slave trade and tearing apart many more slave families.
Oh.
Yeah. It's kind of a good thing and bad thing at the same time. But that's a product of compromise. And I hope the Buzzkillers are aware that the entire Constitution is based on compromise between competing interests and competing geographic regions.
But even now in 2017, and especially now that people are talking a lot about the various controversies going on in various places in the United States around statutes and things like that, the three-fifths compromise, for instance, is coming up a lot.
Exactly. And that's obviously one of the great stains on the Constitution. But that was also the product of a compromise. Because if you're a Southerner, you've got a relatively small white population, but a large slave population, especially in places like South Carolina. And so you worry that you're not going to have the political clout in the nation's capital that you need. And so you want slaves counted for the purposes of representation.
Oh, you mean you won't get as many people
in Congress, in the House of Representatives? Oh, exactly. Okay. So, I mean, if you're a Northerner, for obvious reasons, you would say, "Now, wait a minute. You don't treat these slaves as people for any other purpose. So, why should we count them for representation? It should only be free white people who get counted."
Okay, so every state, every Southern state, would have two senators if you didn't have the three-fifths compromise, but then wouldn't have anywhere
would
near
have the tiny delegations in the House of Representatives.
Oh, so the House of Representatives would have been a northern body.
Pretty much.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And
okay.
So the South, in other words, already at the very beginning of the Republic, Southerners are and Northerners are worried about being outvoted by the other region.
Wow.
So it's not a late problem, it's an early problem. And they manage to they basically sweep it under the rug. They don't talk about it. They come up with these compromises. Ben Franklin, he's a very old man at the time, and it's sort of his last crusade. Joseph Ellis writes about this. He tried to make the Constitutional Convention talk about slavery and maybe even abolish it, but he was tilting at windmills. that was not going to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, and keep in mind, at this time in American history, there really are very, very few abolitionists. There are very few people in anywhere in the country, even though it's being phased out in the North. There are very few Northerners who object to slavery as a moral grounds. Really, the only group that does that are the Quakers. Oh, okay. They are sort of they are this tiny, tiny little fringe group, and everyone else thinks they're crazy for opposing slavery on moral grounds.
And they also think they're crazy because they have this sort of weird way. Well, to people at the time, a weird way of practicing religion.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. It's one of the reasons why Pennsylvania is created. Because Quakers needed a refuge. In any case, early in the 19th century, you have a growing obsession with the political balance in Washington D.C., the new capital, between slave states and free states. I think sometimes people forget. It's like, what's the Missouri Compromise of 1820 about? It's about maintaining this precarious balance between free states and slave states.
Yes. Now, to the moralists in the room, and we flatter ourselves that we are. Well, this sounds like a terrible, terrible thing to do because it's basically arguing that any new states coming to the Union, you have to have another one that's a slave.
Exactly.
State.
You have to sort them into new categories. And so, what happened in a nutshell in 1820 is that Maine, which had been a non-contiguous part of Massachusetts up until this point, is admitted as a free state. And to balance it out, Missouri was admitted as a slave state. Although Missouri sits above the line 3630, which is also enshrined in this compromise as the new line going west, above the line, no slavery, below the line, you can have slavery.
So would in theory, would that go on in perpetuity? You'd have one – if anytime anyone wanted a new state in the West or anywhere else, you'd have to say, okay, well, now we got to come up with a slave state.
Almost always. This, by the way, is one of the reasons why the annexation of Texas is delayed 9 years. And there's this 9-year period between 1836 and 45 when – it was one of the six flags, by the way, where Texas is an independent republic. It's because of the slave issue. And if you look at how it's finally annexed in 1845 – you have a lame duck president, and you have a joint resolution, essentially reconciliation, as we would call it today, but they barely get it through Congress, and that's partly because of this issue.
Oh, wow. So then what comes next?
What comes next? The key, and this is, it's really hard to exaggerate how important this is, the key development is the Mexican War of 1846 to 1848, which is really the most important war in American history that people have never heard of, or that people don't pay attention to.
Yeah,
because it is at relatively little cost to the United States. It vastly increases our size. We were already stretching to the Pacific up north through Oregon country, but entire southwest of the United States, including California, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, a bunch of other areas, are acquired for very little effort in 1848. And as Ralph Waldo Emerson famously once said, We will take Mexico, but it will be as the man who swallows arsenic. In other words, it's his version of saying, "Be careful what you wish for."
Oh, right.
Most Americans were very happy to acquire all of this massive territory from Mexico down to the Rio Grande and all the way to the Pacific in California. But what it really did is open the can of worms called slavery massively.
You'd have to worry about free states, slave states
and
coming in.
What happens to the new territory? And the minute the war starts, you have people in the North saying, yeah, we should take all this territory, but slavery shouldn't be allowed in it.
So every time there seems to be sort of solution or a compromise or an idea about how to solve this into the future, the Three-Fifths Clause, the Missouri Compromise, those things get almost immediately get tested.
That's right. Yes. Wow. Yeah. In fact, to my mind, it's amazing how long the Missouri Compromise lasted. But basically, the Mexican War leads to this massive acquisition of territory. And then basically what happens in the 1850s is this massive struggle over, do you allow slavery to expand into the new territories, or do you prevent it?
Right.
And there are lots and lots of steps in this story, but the, probably the most important is the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, just a few years after the end of the Mexican War.
Right, right.
And this is about some prosaic issues, including building a transcontinental railroad. But basically what the law does is, and it's about organizing what's the new so-called Kansas-Nebraska territory, the territory that will become the states Kansas and Nebraska,
okay,
which is north of the Missouri Compromise line.
Right.
And this passes with overwhelming Southern support because it opens up all the territory north of the 3630 line to what's called popular sovereignty, the notion that you just allow the locals to vote to whether they want slavery or not. In other words, in the areas of the former Louisiana Purchase, which had been closed to slavery by the Missouri Compromise, they are now open to slavery if the locals want it.
Oh, so even though the Missouri Compromise has this line.
Yes. This erases the line.
Utah could become slave. Okay.
And so if people in Montana on the Canadian border decide they want to vote to have slaves, they can do that under the Kansas-Nebraska Act.
Oh, okay. Because I was wondering, with this line, is California going to be Northern California going to be slave? Southern California not
right.
slave?
You know, that's right. Now, by 1850, California has already been admitted as a free state, partly because slavery was never really an issue there. But that's part of an earlier compromise of 1850, which we won't get into.
Okay.
But basically, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, Northern Democrats pay a huge price for this in the 1854 midterm elections, which of course grows the relative weight of Southerners within the Democratic Party. It also, more importantly, spurs the creation of a brand new party to face the Democrats. Up until this point, it's been the Whigs. They basically implode for a variety of reasons. But brand new party, 1854, founded in Wisconsin, known as the Republican Party.
Right. We've heard of that.
And called the Grand Old Party, even though it's the younger of the two parties. Ironies abound.
Now, do the Whigs get folded into the Republicans? Or
yes, a lot of Northern Whigs, also Free Soilers, also some Know-Nothing Party folks.
Oh, wow.
Others get folded into this new party. And this new party...
There's a whole show in this.
Mid-19th century politics is fascinating. But basically what you have is you have... what's called realignment. The parties realign to more, and this is going to happen, to more faithfully reflect the political reality on the ground, which is a North-South division over slavery. And so we shouldn't be surprised to find out you end up with a new, quickly very strong party that's only in the North, the Republican Party, openly committed to the containment of slavery.
So slavery not only causes the Civil War, in generations before, it causes all these other things.
It fundamentally reshapes our entire political system. The Whig Party implodes partly because it was unable to maintain the straddle between Northern Whigs and Southern Whigs. Mm-hmm. The Democrats are going to run into the same problem. It's one of the reasons why Lincoln is elected with only 40% of the popular vote in 1860s, because you have two Democratic candidates. You have a Northern Democrat and a Southern Democrat. And so, in other words, the Democratic Party was also splitting over slavery. And these are just more ways in which slavery leads to the Civil War.
Yeah, so but there's an entire generation of
yes, and there are a whole bunch of crises I'm not even going to talk about, but one obviously is key, and that's Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry in October 1859. John Brown, I highly recommend, by the way, Tony Horwitz's book. It's called Midnight Rising. It's a recent book about John Brown. He's a fascinating guy, not necessarily in a good way, but he's the radical abolitionist to lead all radical abolitionists. He tries to seize a federal arsenal in Harper's Ferry, Virginia, in order to trigger a slave uprising. He fails miserably. By the way, there's reason to believe that he may have actually intended to fail and to become a martyr, which is interesting. Because if you look at his plot, it really is ridiculous and had no hope of working.
Yeah.
And there are little hints, we don't know for sure, little hints that maybe he actually understood that.
Yeah. He ends up killing a lot of people, too, isn't
he? People get killed. He almost gets killed.
Right.
He is only survived because the guy trying to stab him is using a ceremonial sword, not a real one.
Oh, right.
I hate when that happens. He's badly wounded.
A buzzkill blunder.
But yeah, buzzkill blunder. He survives enough to be tried and then hanged, and he does become a martyr.
Right, right. John Brown's body, Liza Mulder.
Exactly.
Right.
And of course, he famously says during the trial that the sins of this land will not be washed away except with blood, something like that. It turns out to be true.
He says this prophetic. In 1859.
59, yeah. He's executed pretty quickly. But this, you should ask yourself, why is this one of the triggers of the Civil War? Why is this such an important event? It's because it confirms all of the worst nightmares of Southern leaders, i.e., some Yankee is going to come and blow up slavery and lead a slave revolt. In other words, not just end slavery, but end it violently with slaves rising up and killing all of us in our beds.
And let's
Nat Turner.
Let's remind the buskillers that John Brown's raid was on a federal arsenal, so it could have blown up.
It was a federal arsenal, yes. And by the way, a lot of Southerners saw him as sort of the tip of the spear, right? He's part of this larger Northern conspiracy, and they weren't entirely wrong. He was backed secretly by some financiers in Boston.
Yeah. And there are all these publications and all these abolitionists writing songs about the freeing just like freeing the Egyptian slaves, freeing the Southern slaves, and although they're evil slave owners, they are afraid.
Yes, absolutely. They're paranoid, and it's late in the 1850s. By this point, extremists on both sides are basically looking for grievances, looking for things to sort of exaggerate and turn up the volume. The center starts to get hollowed out.
Wow.
And in the South after this, they basically say to themselves, okay, first of all, we need to organize for our defense. And so here's where you see Southern state militias taking on a serious form, and it's going to become the Confederate Army. And they also basically conclude that if someone from this new Republican Party is elected president in 1860, we're out. That'll be the last straw.
Oh, they're already talking about this late 59.
In early 60.
Because
certainly once it becomes clear that there's a real powerful Republican Party, and let's remember the majority of the votes, electoral votes, are in the North. The North has much more population. They understand that if a Republican sweeps the North, you're going to have a Republican president.
Right.
And even though this Republican president is only committed to preventing the spread of slavery, certainly in the short term, what most Southerners read that as, this means the destruction of slavery.
This is famously Lincoln's election.
That's right. And this is the one thing the two sides agree on. They both agree that slavery has to expand to survive. So Northerners say if we contain it, then maybe we can destroy it. And that's the extent to which Lincoln is an abolitionist. He doesn't believe in immediate uncompensated abolition the way someone like William Lloyd Garrison does.
Right.
But he believes that if you contain slavery, it will ultimately erode and collapse.
Uh-huh.
And he actually said that publicly once, and Southerners ran with it. They're saying, yeah, he says he's not abolitionist, but he really is.
Yeah.
And even if he didn't, they believed it. They believed that this has to be a thriving institution. And for it to thrive, we have to expand. It's one of the reasons why they try to annex Cuba in the 1850s. A lot of Southerners do.
Holy cow.
Or some of these other ventures in Central America. They want slavery to expand, and they believe that if it doesn't, it's going to die.
Wow.
And so that's why the impending election of Lincoln is such a big deal, especially once it actually happens.
So they're not upset or not worried or not paranoid about his stance on tariffs. They're not worried about his stance on...
Not so much.
Other
not
things.
Not so much.
It's all about his attitude towards the future of slavery.
You know, and the Republican Party stood for other things, like internal improvements. They're sort of like, they're like the inheritors of Hamilton in a way. They want to build a transcontinental railroad.
Right.
They want higher tariffs. There are issues they stand on. But these are not the ones that fire up Southerners in 1860.
Right. So you have two. You have, first of all, I'm surprised the United States survives the 1850s.
Absolutely.
Not alone
and that was a near thing. That was a near thing. You could have had a civil war in 1850.
Wow.
And that was only narrowly averted by this compromise they patched together in 1850, not 1820.
And let's remind the buzzkillers that, it isn't just modern media that turns political debate that we see now into sort of name calling and myth making and fake newsing, so-called fake newsing. Newspapers at the time were very, very widespread, were very, very partisan.
Openly partisan.
And they could have taken something small, Lincoln said, and turned it into this is his major issue and this is what he's going to do.
No, one of the reasons why popular politics is so big once the franchise is opened up under Jackson, right, where you don't have to, for example, own land anymore.
To men, yeah.
As long as you're a white, adult white male. Mm. Participatory politics is really exciting, and part of the reason is it's so hyper-partisan.
Right.
And
right.
So vicious. I mean, you'd have like a Democratic pub, and if you're a Whig and you stumble into it, you were going to get beaten.
Oh, God.
it was that bad. Yeah. People think that sort of partisanship is a modern thing.
Oh, no.
No, not at all.
As one, I always used to wonder why there are so many American historians studying the 1850s. And, you know, I've been learning
that it's a fascinating period, no question.
And there's a lot of good material. Well, we have now Lincoln being elected, or certainly the election of 1860 leading up to paranoia and leading up to Lincoln's election. But what we're going to do to take a break from all this tension is go down to the sponsorship department and hear from them. We'll be back in a minute. Okay, we're back. Professor Nash, we left the United States before we went to the sponsorship department in a very tense time. In the 1850s, we're tearing the country apart, at least rhetorically. And then Lincoln is elected in 1860, and the South believes he's an abolitionist. What happens? What do they do in reaction to this?
Yeah, and let's keep in mind what a big deal this was, because first of all, this grand old party is all of 6 years old at the time, and they've now just won the presidency. By the way, the election where it matters, i.e. in the Electoral College, was not close, because he did so well in the North.
Oh, sure.
Where all electoral votes, where he had 40% of the popular vote, but he dominated in the Electoral College. It wasn't disputed or anything.
Oh, okay. So it's not like this. The Southerners were saying, "Well,
it was rigged or whatever, we were robbed." No, absolutely not. No, they knew that he won fair and square, and it was a fascinating four-way election. You actually had a Southerner, John Bell of the Constitutional Party, who is a Southerner but a Unionist. In other words, he doesn't believe in secession.
Wow.
Proof, by the way, the secession was already a public issue well before the election. So Lincoln wins, and then within a month or so of Lincoln's election, the secession ball starts rolling.
But in theory, there was time to talk about this, because the president wasn't inaugurated until March.
Not inaugurated until March 4th. You had this sort of long lame duck period during which your useless president, the only one ever from Pennsylvania, by the way, James Buchanan, proves his additional uselessness. I mean, not that the circle is going to be squared at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You can't sort of undo Lincoln's election. But Southerners are terrified by Lincoln's election at the White House. By the way, and they've been used to having friendly people in the White House. Even though Buchanan is a Northerner.
Oh, of course.
The Democratic Party was so dominated by slaveholding interests, they were used to getting their way. And so it becomes even more painful when you have this new guy come in you don't know what you're going to get with him, despite all of his reassuring statements. So states start to secede beginning December 1860 with South Carolina. Not surprisingly, that is the hotbed of secessionism, had been for a while. It's also a state, by the way, where the majority of the population is black slaves. Not a coincidence.
Oh, okay.
This is the land of the fire eaters, as they were called.
Oh, yeah.
The most hardcore. John C. Calhoun from South Carolina, right? The guy who said that slavery was a positive good, nothing to be ashamed of.
Mm-hmm.
Not a coincidence. This is the most dependent and the most frightened slave state in the country. They secede first. And then you have six others going into early 1861. And a lot of people don't know this, but secession happens in two waves. The first wave is the bottom seven states from Florida across to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
This happens between December 1860 and I think February, March 1861. I forget. The top.
This happened even before. Some of this happened before Lincoln was elected.
Oh, most of it did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They're not even going to wait.
Not elected. Inaugurated.
Inaugurated. Yeah. Yeah. They don't even wait to see you. They're done. They don't see any future for themselves in a country ruled even for a minute by Abraham Lincoln.
Okay.
So, and then you have fast forward. Lincoln is inaugurated. He tries to keep the country together. His inaugural address is very conciliatory. He's worried about civil war breaking out. He's trying to stop it. And then it becomes an issue of federal property in Southern territory in the form of fortresses like Fort Monroe and Fort Pulaski and famously Fort Sumter.
Oh, okay.
Lincoln's president of the United States. He doesn't see it as his job to hand over federal property and federal fortifications to secessionists, to traitors.
Sumter is a military base.
It's a military base, a crucial one in the mouth of Charleston Harbor. Charleston, one of the major, if not the major, shipping port of the entire South. So he reinforces that fort. Southerners open fire on it on April 12th, 1861, mm-hmm. and take it within a day or two.
Wow.
And then Lincoln says, well, okay, this is obviously war has in effect broken out, a war of secession. And so now I'm going to call for 75,000 volunteers. In other words, I'm going to beef up the Union Army to basically forcibly reunify the country.
Okay.
Because the regular Union Army was a joke in 1861. It had about 16,000 men, had its hands full with the Indians.
Oh, yeah.
So he calls for 75,000 volunteers, which at the time seemed like a huge number. The Union Army at the end of the Civil War is going to be 1 million men.
Oh, my God.
The need is going to expand quite a bit.
Be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Certainly was true.
In any case, that I'm drawing attention to that because that's what leads the top four states, and I mean Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas, then to secede.
Right, okay.
They had been on the fence up until this point.
Oh, so in theory, South Carolina has actually broken off, but nobody else has?
Oh, no. The other six have.
Oh, the other seven. Yes. Okay, gotcha.
Yes, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Florida, and Texas. I don't think I left anybody out. So then the northern four states secede as a group into April and May 1861. And they had, in other words, Lincoln's move, basically saying, I'm going to forcibly reunify the country. Totally understandable move, by the way. Someone elected president of the United States, right? He didn't get elected to oversee the dissolution of the country.
And after being fired, the Fort Sumter
right.
fired upon.
Right, right. The Southerners have said, nothing. We're going to take federal property by force, including killing people, even though they only killed a horse in the bombardment of of Fort Sumter. No casualties. Not the look of things to come, unfortunately.
No.
In any case, so it's that act that pushes them, including Virginia, over onto the side of the Confederacy. Let's also remember that there were slave states, later on called border states, which did not secede. And that's part of Lincoln's management problem. He has to try and wage a war without alienating Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri, which are all slave states that haven't seceded.
Oh, then that's four states.
Well, and it's really important to run this counterfactual. Maryland secedes. The District of Columbia is now entirely surrounded by Confederate territory.
Yeah, yeah.
That would have been
a
problem.
And Kentucky has the Ohio River, or at least the south bank of the Ohio River.
The strategic problem for the United States would have multiplied many, many times had these other states seceded as well. And so Lincoln has to walk on eggshells and make sure that these states are happy and that he doesn't do anything to offend them.
Oh, so initially, is that why initially he's talking about, this is about reunifying the Union?
It is a big reason. It's not the only one, but it's a big reason not to make this a war of emancipation immediately.
Okay, we're still talking about 1861. It's 1860,
right. 61. And by the way, in 1862-63, when he does issue the Emancipation Proclamation, it only refers to slaves at that point in Confederate states.
Oh, so in theory, Kentucky slaves, Missouri
they're
states,
still slaves. And if you've seen the movie Lincoln, it's one of the reasons why the 13th Amendment is so important, because the Emancipation Proclamation only frees slaves in Confederate-held territory as of January 1st, 1863. It doesn't free all the slaves.
Okay.
There's still thousands and thousands of slaves legally held. He didn't have the legal authority. This was the Emancipation Proclamation was a war measure.
Oh, right.
When you wage war against a foreign power, which, by the way, you're only selectively considering a foreign power if you're Abraham Lincoln.
When you want to call it that.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So when it's convenient, you say, we're seizing the enemy's military and economic assets. That's why the Emancipation Proclamation is framed as it is in a very limited document.
Huh. But that's a new one to many buzzkillers, I'm sure.
Yeah. In any case, let's talk about the secession process, because if you look at it carefully, here's where the proof is in the pudding, that this is, once again, about slavery. It's not about states' rights. It's not about the tariff. It's not about alternative ways of life, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
The southern states seceded individually by state convention. They had a state convention where they decided, they voted by district representative, whether to secede.
Yeah.
In some states, and I hope none of the buzzkillers think that sort of the entire South rose up as one to secede.
Well, they should, because it's state by state.
Not even close. There were some states where the vote was close.
Oh, really?
There also, if you look, and these maps are readily available, if you look at how individual districts voted, whether yes, we should secede, no, we shouldn't, there's a high correlation between those states that voted yes to secede and the presence of or their dependence on slavery.
Oh, okay.
If you look at the map, places in particular, eastern Tennessee and western Virginia, not coincidentally soon to become West Virginia in
very
the middle of the Civil War.
Yeah, not cotton producing.
You have few, if any, slaves in some of these counties. And so these areas, not coincidentally, don't vote to secede. Wow. Right? If this is about some other issue, why is there this correlation, I wonder?
Yeah.
By the way, this is, in case people don't know, this is where this thing called West Virginia comes from. In the middle of the Civil War, it secedes from Virginia. All the western counties where slavery was not a thing. By the way, it was almost called the state of Kanaw.
K-A-N-A-W-H-A,
something like that. I forget how to spell it. It's the name of the river in the area.
Oh, okay.
West Virginia is a little more felicitous. Yes. In any case, you had a bunch of districts voting against, and there is a huge correlation between presence of slavery, non-presence of slavery. Also, during the war, just for, let me just mention this now, the South was not completely unified during the war. Once Virginia secedes, for example, 40% of the U.S. Army officers from Virginia stick with the Union.
40%? And this is Virginia.
This is Virginia. This is, in some ways, you know, this is where the capital of the Confederacy is going to be. This is where Robert E. Lee is from. By the way, this happened in almost all states. And this is one of the reasons why you literally, in some cases, have brother fighting against brother, where you have families where some soldiers join the North, some soldiers join the South.
Oh, it isn't just on border states. It's because Southerners want
to... You had Southerners. Wow. By the time the Civil War is over, 100,000 Southerners served in the United States Army. That's, actually, that's not a tenth, because you have more than a million who serve total. But still, it's a very significant percentage. Every Confederate state except South Carolina raises at least a battalion of troops. So in other words, you have something like the 1st Virginia Regiment, which is in the U.S. Army. If you look at the numbers are online. There are a couple of states where over 20,000 white Southerners joined the United States Army during the war.
Do they have to up sticks and go north or what?
Oh, yeah. Well, unless they join the Northern Army that has invaded their area, which probably happened in some cases. Not that people care, but I also have interesting cases like one of my ancestors who tried to join the Union Army and was rejected because he was only 16. So he promptly went south and joined the Confederate Army.
He just wanted to fight.
He just wanted to kill somebody, I guess. And by the way, later on when he became of age, he deserted the Confederate Army and joined the Union Army.
You Nashes are all the same.
I know. Thank you. And that's not an isolated incident, by the way. You had lots of people switching sides, especially once the South starts to lose. You have people deserting, joining the North. Anyway.
I'm not laughing, buzzkillers, or not, reacting this way because I think it's funny. It's just so, it's so illuminating and so strange in many ways.
It's just so bizarre,
you know.
And it wasn't typical. And I've not seen the movie, but there is also this place called the Free State of Jones County, Alabama, which literally became, in effect, an independent state where the Confederate Army knew not to tread because they'd be shot at by the locals who were, shall we say, fiercely pro-Union, even though they're in the heart of Alabama.
This is deep Alabama, too.
Deep Alabama.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Sometimes it's called the Kingdom of Jones.
Oh, I like that better. I like that better. Yeah. A lot better. Lady Buzzkill would like that a whole lot more.
I need to see the movie, because apparently they went to great pains to make that an accurate movie, but I'd like to see it. And then you look at the documents that these states issue once they decide to secede. Sometimes they're called ordinances of secession. Sometimes they're called declarations of immediate causes. Some of them are sort of content-free. In other words, they don't have any justification or motivation in them. They just say, look, we're here, we're seceding, we're sundering the Union or whatever, and we're pulling out.
It's a three-line document.
It's a longer document, but it's basically, here's what this means. In other words, no more U.S. Postal Service in our state and stuff like that. I mean, it's sort of a technical document.
Get a new zip code.
Obviously not down to that level of detail, but it's sort of a technical document. It doesn't say, here's why we're seceding. In those cases, and I think it's about five of them, in those cases where they do list a cause, all of them refer to slavery in some way. Sometimes it's a little more indirect. Sometimes, like in South Carolina, it's very direct. Like, basically, here's why we're seceding. We need to preserve slavery.
In fact, the Buzzkill Institute researchers dug some of these up for us. And in South Carolina, for instance, up 41% of the causes listed in those documents are slavery. And if you take out what they call context, which is, you know, this is South Carolina and we're doing this, then it becomes 60% slavery. And Georgia's the same way. Mississippi's even more, 73% slavery. Texas is similar. It's not unclear at all.
Right. And this is not trivia. You know, this, right, obviously, right. This is one piece of evidence. But still, if your argument is this wasn't about slavery, then you have to come up with some other evidence rather than just this long post-Civil War assertion that this was about states' rights.
Yeah.
You have to point to evidence like this. And when you look at evidence like this, it points toward slavery as the motive. And by the way, there were states where they had, you know, no motivation in their official secession statement. But in those cases, if you look at what the leading politicians of those states are saying, like their governors, mm-hmm. they are almost to a man referring to slavery.
Right. As the main cause.
So, I mean, and this is History 101. If you want to find out what people were thinking at the time, go look at what they said at the time. Right. Don't look at what they said when they're in retirement in 1890 and they're creating this lost cause myth.
Yeah, which we'll talk about in a future episode.
Which we'll talk about later. What are they doing and saying at the time? They are acting and speaking as if this is primarily about slavery.
And we talk about evidence, and the timing of evidence is very, very important. This is the 1860, 1861 right. evidence.
Right.
And it's overwhelming. It is the elephant in the room, as you keep saying.
You can also run a thought experiment. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that this was about states' rights.
Mm-hmm.
Let's concede the argument. Yes, the South in 1861 seceded because of states' rights. Ask yourself this. States' rights to do what?
Right.
What, apart from your right to continue holding slaves, or more to the point, continue to expand in slavery to the West, mm-hmm. what state right is being violated by Northerners such that you have to secede?
And we know it's not the tariff because, first of all, tariffs aren't that different.
And tariffs also had been lowered after the 1830s significantly.
Right,
because of that crisis in part and all for other reasons. But it was not an issue in 1861, not a big national issue that was tearing the country apart.
Okay.
You know, you might disagree on how to organize new territories in other ways, right? But should we build a transcontinental railroad at public expense? Where should it be? Right? Mm-hmm. Should we should we have what we'd say today, the equivalent of big government or small government? Yeah, you'd have disagreements over that.
Sure.
But those were not the cause of secession.
Right.
Those issues are, to the extent that they're issues at all, they are grossly inflated by former Confederates and white supremacists long after the Civil War.
We're talking decades after, too.
Exactly. It's not immediate. It takes a while. That's absolutely right. In any case, you also look at something like, it's a famous document for a good reason, the I guess soon to be, I don't know if he was at the time, the vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stephens,
mm-hmm.
Gave this famous cornerstone speech at the time in which he openly talks about this essentially is a virtual quotation. This republic is founded on the principle that blacks are not and can never be equal.
Right.
Right. This is, and you know, we would keep them where they belong, i.e. in chains, and Northerners would free them and destroy the country.
Wow. That's about as clear a statement as you can.
Yeah. And he doesn't, if you read the cornerstone speech, he doesn't dance around the bush. You know, he's
beat around the bush.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, and then ask yourself, okay, is this about the Southern way of life? Run the same experiment. Southern way of life to do what?
Yeah.
Are the Northerners, they're trying to eliminate your ability to drink mint julep?
Or capitalism or nothing like that. It's all exactly. The same apart from slavery.
Exactly. And it's become sort of academic. Now, once the war starts, you do have some Confederates and rebels who, if you were to ask them, like, and there was some evidence of this from the times, like, why are you fighting? You know,
right.
Individual soldiers would say, well, it's because I'm protecting my homeland against Yankee invasion.
Right.
And keep in mind that for the Yankees, for the North to win, they have to invade and crush the South.
Yeah,
The South is trying to stay alive, and the North is trying to strangle them.
Strangle the
Confederacy, I should say. So then it becomes sort of this defensive homeland myth or defensive homeland claim. And that's true, right? You know, a lot of Southern soldiers, just like a lot of Northern soldiers, not highly educated, you know, aren't up on the issues, don't necessarily read a newspaper. By the way, there's a lot of illiteracy in this time still.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, that the idea that, well, I'm going to keep Yankees out of my state, that resonates with them.
But presumably some Northern Pennsylvania, soldiers join once, you know, to keep the Southerners out of Gettysburg.
To protect Southern Pennsylvania, certainly. Many saw it that way, but that's once the war is underway.
This is after
the fighting has already started, and it's clear that, by the way, huge portions of the South were occupied by the North right away. Like if you look at western Tennessee, for example.
Oh, no kidding.
That folds very, very quickly. New Orleans is occupied early 1862, basically without firing a shot.
Wow.
So there are.
And that's a big port.
It's a big port. Already the Mississippi is slowly being, the Mississippi Valley is being taken over by the Union in large chunks early on. So you have a lot of Confederate territory that is occupied. But once again, it begs the question, like, why is your homeland being invaded? Well, it's because you decided to secede. You decided to wage war against the Union, which most loyal Americans hold sacred.
Right.
So you kind of have to expect to be invaded, right?
Yeah.
Because what you want is to be left alone and to become an independent country.
Mm-hmm.
The North sort of has to invade you. And it's amazing in subsequent years, even today, how much this issue of slavery either gets downplayed or ignored. It's not surprising. We often, and everyone else does this too, we whitewash history. We try to avoid controversy. We try to make everyone feel good about the history. And so slavery is ugly, and slavery is a motive for war, and secession is ugly, so we brush it under the carpet.
Right.
I remember I took, this was years ago, I took a tour of the Antietam battlefield, which I highly recommend, by the way. It's a great site. And the tour was led by a ranger who did an excellent job. Those people are awesome. They don't get a lot.
National Park Service.
They don't get enough love. He ended his talk. And remember, he doesn't know where his audience is from. They're from all over. A lot of them are going to be Southerners.
Yeah.
He ends his talk by saying, and so basically it's a good thing this was a Union victory because it helped make it so that we, at the end of the day, were one country instead of two. Totally legit.
Right.
He could have been more milquetoast than that, by the way. He didn't have to put that in. In the context, I thought it was kind of bold. But you notice he didn't say a thing about slavery.
Right.
And to the extent that, by the way, it's the same with the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C.
Right, the famous one.
Obviously it has on one side, if I'm remembering correctly, on the inside, they have the entire text of the Gettysburg Address.
Yes,
which does allude to the destruction of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
But the epitaph for Lincoln, which I believe is either on his base or up behind him, one of the two, it talks about him restoring the Union. Oh, sorry, he saved the Union. Nothing about freeing the slaves.
Okay.
And let's keep in mind that in 1922, when this memorial to Lincoln is dedicated, the audience at the dedication is racially segregated.
Yeah.
Blacks had to sit at the back.
Yeah.
How perfect. How to honor old Abe, right?
Right. But of course, by saying he saved the Union, it sort of implies ending slavery.
Right. Because everyone knows that slavery disappears afterwards.
But it could have been a lot more bold.
And
than that.
We wouldn't have had to add that many words to say saved the Union and freed the slaves. It's just a few words, right? Today you could do it on Twitter.
140 characters for the Stonemason. But when does the 13th Amendment get passed? So in other words,
1865. Actually, before the war is over at the very end.
Okay, so in theory, he's responsible for both.
Yes.
Okay, so...
Yeah. So correct.
There's no way to...
Right, no, I wasn't referring just to the Emancipation Proclamation, but...
Gotcha,
to the,
yes. Okay.
So, no, and once again, the movie Lincoln is pretty accurate in this regard, that it becomes a big issue for him, and he does the nasty politics to make sure it passes, because it was not a done deal necessarily.
Now, but you have mentioned something, and we cannot go a step further without bringing
you,
this
you
up.
You noticed that, did you?
I noticed this. Dolly Parton's Dixie Stampede. What in the world is that?
Okay, I don't remember this. I have to cop to it. I didn't know what Dolly Parton's Dixie Stampede was either until I saw an article about it recently.
Now, this is the Dolly Parton that we know.
Dolly Parton has this industry. Some of it is in Pigeon Forge, where she has these sort of
in Tennessee,
resorts.
Right?
Yes, it's in eastern Tennessee, ironically enough. These are these sort of resorts where you can go and you can eat and you can stay and you can see live music performances, etc. This one part of, and I think there's more than one of these, this place called Dolly, I think it's just called Dolly's Dixie Stampede. What I liken it to, because I think it's very similar, I've been to this thing, and I know there's one at a mall in Maryland. It's called Medieval Times.
Oh, yeah.
It's basically, you go into this sort of very small stadium, and they serve you food, and then they have, in the arena, they have this entertainment. In medieval mm-hmm. times, they have knights jousting, and they have a prince and princess and stuff like this. And so it's very hokey, but a lot of people love it. I had a good time. I went there with students once, so that's why I know what it is. This sounds like the Civil War version of that. And you have the same sort of small stadium, which they divide into blue and gray, and you pick a color.
Oh.
I think it was on Slate. I urge Buzzkillers to read the article.
Slate.com.
Slate.com, sorry. Right. If you Google Dolly's Dixie Stampede, I think that will come up quickly.
But you're not putting it on the Buzzkill bookshelf.
The thrust of the article was, this is about the Civil War, but it takes all the meaning out of it, and there are no references to slavery. It's just, as the article describes it, it becomes like a sporting event between two teams, one blue-colored and one gray-colored.
Oh, In other words, blue and gray game.
Right, blue and gray game, exactly. So all the content gets sucked out of it.
Oh, and, so everyone's a gallant officer, and
exactly,
everyone's...
Right. And feeds very much into what we're going to talk about in a later episode. But... On the one hand, right, you don't want to offend anybody. On the one hand, people like me shouldn't complain too much about this. It is, after all, entertainment, right? You shouldn't go into Dolly's Dixie Stampede and says, I want to learn about the Civil War, right? That should not be your reaction. On the other hand, I think it is emblematic of how, to avoid offending anyone, especially Southerners, we remove all the meaning from the Civil War. We remove the motive from it.
Yeah. And Gone with the Wind is that
Gone
way.
With the Wind does
Gone
that.
Gone with the Wind does that terribly.
Yep. So, let me switch the focus a little bit here before.
Yeah, let's get off Dixie's. Let's get off Dixie's. Dolly's Dixie Stampede.
We're now done with the Dolly Parton product placement.
Boy, we used to have Churchill quote or no quote. We're gonna have to bring a Dolly Parton thing in.
What are Dolly's views on the Civil War? So this is really important too, because the war. If you look at war aims, basically, why is one side fighting? From the beginning and throughout the war, the main reason the South is fighting is to preserve slavery. You secede from the Union so you can preserve what you call your way of life, the basis of your economy, whatever you want to call it.
And to spread it to the West.
But it's really, really important to you, and it's so important it's worth seceding, and it's worth fighting and killing large numbers of people to preserve your independence, your new independence. For the North, it's a very different picture. Because for the North, the war begins not as a war to destroy slavery.
Right. So 1861, it isn't. War,
absolutely not. If you look at everything the North is doing, certainly everything Lincoln is doing, it's about preserving the Union. It is not, he deliberately makes it not a war about slavery. And he disappoints abolitionists for the first year or two of the war.
Oh, yeah.
Because, of course, they're all clamoring for, wow, let's make this war worth something. Make it a war for slavery. Mm-hmm. And once for lots of obvious reasons, like the border states, Lincoln knows he can't do it. And forget about the border states. He still has to. It's still a democracy in the North. They still have fair elections. Mm-hmm. Democrats can and will make use of this issue to hammer him and to take away Republican seats, like in the 1862 midterm elections.
If he makes it about slavery.
So it's a war to preserve the Union. And in this sense, and in this sense only, it seems to me this is one of the reasons why it's actually a good thing that the war lasts a while. That may sound really, really odd. I'm not in favor of carnage.
No, Civil War was carnage.
Unbelievable. By the way, in recent years, they have new estimates for the total number of dead, which have been revised way upward. I think it's still disputed. Oh. But for the longest time, the total dead was 620,000.
Yeah.
360,000 North, 260,000 South. And those were seemed to be good numbers. By the way, more than half them from disease.
Oh.
Yeah.
Could be post-wound disease. But
so the carnage is already awful, but the newer estimates are more like 750,000 dead.
Three quarters of a million
people in a country with 31 million people.
Yeah.
Every fourth white Southern adult lost his life. So the carnage was amazing, and amazing in not a good way. But this was a war for Union at first in the North. And had the war, let's say, run the counterfactual, let's say the war ends in 1861. Bull Run turns out to be a huge Union victory. They take Richmond and the Confederacy collapses.
Yeah.
I'm here to tell you that the country would have been reunified and slavery would have been preserved in the South.
Oh.
Yeah. I think the price that the South would have paid at that point was no more slavery in the West. But you would not have had immediate abolition.
Oh, okay.
Not even close. Partly because they would have had to compensate the slave owners.
Oh, okay.
Which would have broken the bank.
Oh, wow.
To fairly compensate. And by the way, and how do you determine the price?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And, you know, we have a commerce clause. The government is not empowered to take property from individuals without compensation. You can't do that. You would have had to amend the Constitution, which never wouldn't have happened once you readmitted the Southern representatives. In any case,
it's only the 13th Amendment that makes that
correct, which you can pass because you have no Southerners in your Congress at the time. Yeah, it's funny how that works.
Okay.
But my point is, because the war dragged on and the North had its hands full and could not quickly crush the South. And then we get in 1862, and especially in the East, we have a stalemate where Lincoln, as I'm sure Buzzkiller's aware, is burning through his generals.
Right, right, right.
One after the other gets schooled by Robert E. Lee and humiliated on the battlefield despite their superior numbers. And he's pulling his hair out. How do we put down this rebellion? And that's when he and the people around him seize upon emancipation as a war measure.
Okay.
And it was pure practicality. Was Lincoln personally opposed to slavery? Of course he was.
Yeah, yeah.
But this was a practical move. How do you stick it to the South? How do you undermine their ability to wage war? You knock out their economic support.
Okay, and is it only because is the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863 only because the they were not Lincoln's party wasn't afraid of what had happened in the 1862 midterm elections?
Well, no. Well, he issues the proclamation in September 1862, and it goes into effect January 1st.
Oh, 1863. I see. Okay, gotcha, right. Gotcha.
Yeah, so he announces it publicly, and they suffer losses. Democrats run with that issue.
So he did it even despite that.
Because let's face it, most Northern whites are racists.
Yeah,
and
sure.
For example, they worry, what happens if you free all these slaves, and they come north and compete with me for a job, and I can't compete? They'll work for much less than I do.
Right? Oh, yeah.
You'll depress wages, among other things. Most Northern whites are racists. And by the way, most Northern whites who oppose the expansion of slavery are also racists. They're free soilers. They want the West preserved for free white people. They don't want to compete with black slaves. They're not abolitionists. They don't believe that slavery is evil.
Mm-hmm.
Only believe it's an economic threat to them. In any case, so the war morphs into a war for union and for emancipation.
Right, right, right.
And that's the support for that grows and grows and grows. And by the time you get to early 1865, you can barely manage enough support to amend the Constitution to emancipate all slaves. By the way, if you look at the movie Lincoln, they worry that if the war ends and we haven't passed the 13th Amendment, do we have to return all these slaves to their owners? Right? You've defeated the South and forced them to stay in the country. That doesn't mean you get to keep all the slaves you've compensated.
Because
that was a war measure.
Emancipation
was a war measure. Yeah, yeah. You've done it as commander-in-chief. You haven't done it by law. You haven't done it as president. You've done it as commander-in-chief. It's a big problem for Lincoln. It's only solved because the 13th Amendment passes and it eliminates slavery everywhere for all time in all states.
Wow. Boy, if there's going to be a cause and then the ultimate solving of a problem, that has to be it. Amendment to the Constitution.
Absolutely. Right. That's in our system, that's the last word, and that's the only way you can do it. The only last thing I'll say is, let's run the argument. Let's say this war is not about slavery. Let's say the South secedes because of states' rights or tariff or something else. I would say you can ignore that issue. Look at the result.
Yeah.
What if the South wins the Civil War? What happens? Two basic realities. One, you have two countries instead of one, which would have huge implications. Huge implications for the future of the United States in the world, by the way, in terms of its power, its prestige, its economy, right? If that's an international border separating North and South, think of all the issues. Think about the British would be able to take advantage, by the way, of that situation where it grossly weakened the United States.
Cotton trade and everything else.
Yeah, you'd have two countries instead of one. And most important of all, slavery would be preserved. Yep. Even if you only seceded for quote-unquote states' rights, you weren't going to secede, get an independent country, and say, oh, by the way, you know what? We just noticed slavery's evil. Y'all can go free.
Yeah.
That just would not have happened, right? Slavery would have been preserved. Would it have faded out on its own? Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Would international pressure for abolition have grown? Maybe. Right? Maybe some economic boycotts of the United States? I don't know. I mean, it does fade out officially, not unofficially, unfortunately, everywhere.
Right?
There are no official slave societies anymore. What probably would happen sometime. But how much human misery in the intervening decades for 4+ million Americans?
Well, that's an awful lot to think about, Buzzkillers, and it's an awful lot to keep in mind when this issue comes up again and again in the media, and it's brought up again and again in current events. Talk to you next week.